5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Howdy, Croc Nation. Dr. Tom Iannelli here with you with another amazing Croc podcast. Why do I say amazing? Is it because I'm amazing? No. Is it because Angel is amazing? Maybe. But the reason is because you guys are amazing, our cancer survivors slash thrivers. We are here for you with another Croc podcast. With me, as always, my Robin to my Batman, my Toto to my Dorothy is my guy, Angel Santana. Have faith, let it begin. Angel, no offense with the Toto one.
No, I'm just kidding. What's going on, everybody? Looking good, feeling good. It's a late Friday night for us, recording this, because it's, of course, Good Friday and Easter weekend. So it's great to be with you on this late evening as we come together and just do everything in our part to change some lives and help out.
Yep. And that's our goal. And Angel, I'm very excited about tonight. We have a really short and sweet podcast. We had a tremendously impactful podcast last week with Sanjay, and I would recommend that all of our listeners go back to listen to that young man. He's very special. He's going to be something. And looking forward, hopefully, if we can get a date to get Len back on, that would be wonderful as well. A couple of things to look forward to, Angel. We have our board meeting coming up on Wednesday, and we're going to get to see each other. But most importantly, is tonight's podcast. So we haven't done a confessions podcast in a long time.
You know, it's funny when you send me the synopsis, which was early for the first time. Hey, usually it's after we record. I said, does he want to do a rewind? And I said, wait a minute, we haven't done one. So I agree.
So for those of you who are new, or maybe those of you who don't know this, every once in a while, something will happen to me in work. Something will happen to me in the office that moves me, that I notice something that I may have, you know, that I could have done better in interaction with a survivor slash thriver that has gone wrong because of me. And even though it is embarrassing to do these confession modules or these episodes, I will say that they're important because I think that all of our caregivers out there have to lay their guts on the table for you guys. And that means that, you know, being accountable for the times that we don't, you know, hold up our end of the bargain or do the right thing, don't, you know, hold the wall up for you guys. It really needs to be discussed and dissected and investigated and try to come up with some answers. So without any further ado, the title of today's podcast is Confessions. Survivors can do no wrong, even if they are wrong. So there is this very special patient. We're going to call him Jim Smith. We'll keep his identity private. But I really, really like this guy, not just as one of my patients, but as a person. He's very sweet. He is, as far as he does have some issues with comprehension, you know, he doesn't get the full story all the time, and you do really need to spend some time with him. And he's very, and I don't mean simple-minded in a negative way, but the way he views the world is very simple. And when someone tells him something, he takes it very seriously and very concretely. So as a result, you know, I first met him several years ago, and he came to me with a high risk type of cancer. And, you know, he did very well with his treatments. He did fantastic. But what he was apt to do, he did what he was apt to do. He was lost in the sauce, and he never came back for follow up. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, I got a call from him a couple years later. And he basically called to say goodbye to me, that he was ready to die. And I got him in the office immediately. The system brought him back to life. We got him exactly where he needed to be. And I'm pleased to say that he did a a great job. He listened to us. We spent hours with him. We were explaining to him, teaching him, reviewing with him, and we got him back on track, and we got him, you know, down the right path, and he was doing really great. And then one day, my phone rings at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I pick it up immediately. And what my thoughts are is that, okay, what's going to happen? Obviously I'm thinking he's got some problems now, right? My first thought is it's an emergency. My second thought is he's dying. The third thought is that he's in trouble and he needs me. And basically it didn't turn out to be that. He just happened to call me. He wasn't in any trouble. The fact was he couldn't sleep because of the medications he was on, and he just wanted to talk, and he wanted to basically revert to that same behavior of him, you know, not knowing what was going on and just kind of acting like, you know, in sort of a little bit of a childlike manner. And Angel, I have to tell you, I lost my cool, and it was like not nice, and it was not pretty. And it was like, what were you thinking, Jim? You know, blah, 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 blah. And I wasn't proud of myself, especially with this very, very nice man who really has big problems. So today's podcast we're going to kind of break down this process of what happened to me, what happens to all of us. You know, it's not just, I mean, I'm doing this confessions module about me, but of course it's not about me. It's about all of us, the pressures we're under to take care of these fine patients. And sometimes those moments when we are human and we break down. So the first thing I want to do, Angel, is I want to talk about the history of physician reactivity. And that's a really just a nice way of saying the history of physicians having infantile tantrums. That's probably a better way of explaining it. So I have six sort of bullet points. So when I was a young student, it was my first exposure to watching an attending physician, you know, behave badly. And we have this, at least in the day, 40 years ago, you know, doctors were famous for throwing shoes. They would throw their shoes at people. They would throw their shoes at nurses. They would throw their shoes all over the place. It was almost, if I don't know if you remember, the basketball coach Bobby Knight for University of Indiana, when he threw a chair across the, you know, having his tantrum. And I have seen, you know, grown physicians, you know, learned doctors, you know, throwing shoes at people to make a point. So, you know, that was sort of my first sort of interaction with physicians behaving badly. I have seen physicians have tantrums over the smallest things, being given the wrong instrument in the OR, or one of, you know, our colleagues, whether it be a nurse or whatever, making a small mistake, clerical staff not getting the records, and then having these grown, educated, learned people, you know, break down and start, you know, doing everything short of throwing themselves on the ground and having like a tantrum that Ariel might have had, you know, when she was a young kid. My daughter Beth, she was my tantrum kid. Condescending comments, you know, speaking like everyone is below them. I've seen it a million times. Sarcasm, demeaning comments, putting people down. There were two urologists that I worked in the same hospital with that they would make people cry all the time. They were absolutely brutal. And I just have seen this history and wanted to kind of use it sort of as a springboard to some of the bad behavior that physicians do exhibit at times and elicit from an interaction with a patient. And I want to get down to the etiology of where this inappropriate behavior comes from. And I came up with 10, and I'm sure there's more, but I just 10 came to mind immediately. There's a standing joke that I tell my patients all the time. It goes like this, Angel. What is the difference between God and a doctor? And do you know the answer?
No.
The answer is God doesn't think he's a doctor.
Not bad.
With the implication that doctors think that they're God. So yeah. There's the God complex, and that, happy to report, much less so now. But in the day, doctors did have that God complex, and it could be, and we'll get to this in one of the 10 points. But I guess it's that life and death rush of being able to come to a person who's, on the brink of death and be able to steal, death out of the jaws of life, or opposite to that, actually steal life out of the jaws of death. Number two is our training. And I want to kind of, especially the older training, and I call that the brainwashing. And that's basically, they try to train us to become robots, like to be not even human. And they teach us and they train us to be great at what we do and to be technically skilled, and to be very insightful when it comes to recognizing diseases and be diagnosticians. And our surgeons, the skills with their hands and things like that. But there was a missing component, to the teachings in school and in our training. There was missing the points of humanism and philosophy. And no one ever taught us how to be good leaders. They never taught us how to be humble and have humility. And they never taught us the simple concept of manners, We basically got to behave any way we wanted to, and there were really no repercussions to that behavior. Number three is that the medical system is a very top-heavy system, and it's a bad model. It's not I always preach on this podcast that the model has to be more egalitarian. It has to be more equal. The physician should be in the middle. He or she shouldn't be on the top. They should lead from the middle. They shouldn't be better than others. They shouldn't be thought of as different from others. They shouldn't be thought of as more special. Number four, I call ego and elitism. Trying to become a doctor, getting accepted into a top medical school, especially in the United States, and getting through that program and then getting through residency is absolutely, difficult at the best, meaning that it's almost impossible. And the people that do get in and get through, it gives them sort of a sense of feeling that they're better than others and smarter than others and more gifted than others. And I think this also has a lot to do with the way we used to behave. And getting back, as I said, to the life and death, we deal in life and death, not in bacon and eggs. We basically have to make these decisions, and they're tough decisions. And as a result, at the end of the day, the decisions we make, are far more weighty than the decisions that most other people have to make in their day-to-day lives. And in a sense, that also makes us feel different or quote unquote better than others. We're also taught to be perfectionists because we have no choice. The process of getting ready for an operation is a perfect example. It's called the prepping and draping of a patient. And it's almost like a dance. It's almost like a very precise dance where, the patient is put to sleep, anesthetized, and then there's the process of isolating the area and then, sterilizing the area and then draping the area. It's a very nice metaphor, for the perfectionism that we're taught in everything that we do. We're taught this perfectionism. And I think we hold everyone around us to the same perfectionism. It's almost as if you were a parent and you expected your kids to be perfect, even when they were young and they were incapable of such perfection. You can imagine how those children who had parents like that, how messed up those kids probably became as adults. Community standing is much less than it used to be. But in the old days, you know, when you would walk around out of the hospital, and if you were recognized, you were thought of with great respect and with great, deference, and you were treated differently. People treated you, differently than someone else. So many times in my life, someone would say, "Wow, I saw you talking to Joe, what do you call?" And, that guy's a real jerk. And I'll say, "Really? You know, really? He was just so freaking nice to me. What are you talking about?" But the guy is a jerk. He did X, Y, and Z, and he's just not a good person. And he was caught, stealing money from the poor box or whatever. Just not a good guy. But I would have never known that because I got treated differently than another person. And again, that makes us feel different. Also, we get intimate glimpses, both physically and personally into people's lives. We have access. It's almost as if we have the key to the safe, right? The key to the safe and the sanctity of our patient's humanity. We tell them to strip down. We tell them to take off their clothes. We ask them how old they are. We ask them very intimate questions about every aspect of their life, whether it be their personal life, their medical life, their habits, if they smoke tobacco, if they drink alcohol, not just like, and we'll spend 10 minutes talking about how many cigarettes they smoke in a day, how much alcohol they consume, what alcohol, what brands, how many ounces, and don't even get me started about sex. We also, get, dirty and deep about everything. That's if we're doing our jobs correctly. And again, this gives us sort of that feeling, that sort of position that puts us above others. And number nine is we're also part, and this is changing too, for the better. When I first started, I joined this very, I felt like I was joining the secret society where we all vouched for each other. It's almost as if like you're out with the guys and one of your buddies hooks up with the girl at the bar, but he's married. And then the wife comes screaming, yelling, "Where was Angel last night?" Well, I won't use Angel, but "Where was, Jack last night?" And, "Oh no, Jack was with us the whole time." Like he didn't like disappear for 20 minutes in the parking lot. He was with us the entire night, 100%. It's almost like that secret society, like the Skull and Bones, at Yale, where, all of these rich kids, go into this like windowless, cement building, and they do whatever they do behind those,
in the skulls,
in those, right, in those rituals. It's like, and the other thing is, standing up for each other and watching each other's backs and, not whistleblowing when somebody, does something terrible or does, commits malpractice or, behaves inappropriately, like we're talking about today. There was never the support from the other caregivers that there is now. And I'm very happy to report that everything we're talking about today is really disappearing. But I just wanted to kind of give an overview of everything. So that's the secret society. And lastly, what does this do to us? All of these things that I'm talking about sort of make us, narcissistic. And what exactly is narcissism? Because we talk about narcissism all the time in our day-to-day lives. And if you pick up any newspaper or magazine, there's almost always an article about, the narcissistic society and the way the world is so narcissistic and what percentage of people have narcissism as a personality trait. But really, to me, narcissism really means one thing. It's the inability or not being capable of being able to empathize. And empathy is so important, especially when it comes to serving our survivor thrivers, because we might be caregivers that don't have cancer, but we really need to know to get as close as we possibly can without having cancer, to be able to understand what it must be like to walk in the shoes of a survivor thriver, for a day. Like, what are they going through? The fears, the betrayals, all of the pain and the toxicity and the long-term side effects and the sense of loss and all of that kind of stuff. We need to be able to empathize for us to be able to do our job better. So that's kind of what I was thinking, Angel, about what was the history of this physician reactivity, give a couple of stories and personal, you know, anecdotes from my career, and then kind of talk about where this came from, why it became so, why was it okay for physicians to act that way. But now we're going to look at something from a different perspective. I call this, what are the characteristics that our survivor thrivers or our patients, if you know, because this can, you know, relate globally to medicine, not just in oncology, but what are those characteristics that legitimately can drive a healthcare provider crazy? So these are some of the things that might be triggers that might cause that reactivity. We saw where that reactivity came from, the history of that reactivity. Now we're going to talk about what some of the triggers are. And I put 12. Again, there's probably a million more, but these are the ones that come to mind. Many times, you know, especially people that have gone through extensive education, as physicians and nurses do, then we're charged with the care of someone like Jim, who has limited capacity. They don't have that same intellectual range where they're able to comprehend everything that's going on and really understand it fully and appropriately. And that could sometimes drive a caregiver crazy, because they're trying really hard to relate this really precise and high level information and trying to deliver it to someone who may not understand it. So that would drive certain people crazy. We get driven crazy by patients that have anxious illogic. That means that they have a little bit of knowledge and they go on Dr. Google, and we did a podcast on this, and that little bit of knowledge can be so dangerous. So in my field, one of the things I see, you know, I won't say on a daily basis, but absolutely several times a week, is a woman who gets diagnosed with left-sided breast cancer and they need radiation. They're absolutely freaked out and convinced that we're going to blow up their heart. Even though I tell them we're not going to be anywhere near their heart, they have this illogical, you know, anxiety about that. And that could drive you crazy, because you're really trying so nicely to explain and draw pictures and show diagrams, and it's just not working. It's just, we're not being able to get through that anxiety. One of the things that drives me absolutely crazy, both in my job and in general, is circular conversations. So these are the type of patients that you go through everything. You're very patient. You take your time. You try to make sure everything you say is relatable and understandable. And then the patient will ask a question, and then you get, you sort of that dog chasing its tail. You get caught up in this circle and you need to get to the next part of the talk, but you can't leave because you're not going anywhere. You're just going in a circle. So you'll say something, you'll think that they understand it, and then they just can't get past it, just can't get past that circle. Number four, there's a lack of trust in the medical machine, and that's appropriate. But sometimes you have people that are, you know, pretty paranoid about, you know, the hospital. You know, I had a friend who went to your hospital and they died. Well, yeah, people die. Well, they died in your hospital. Yeah, people die in our hospital. You know, it's almost like the conspiracy theorists, you know, like there's aliens that, you know, the government has hidden somewhere, and, you know, that we know who killed Kennedy, and, you know, all these types of conspiracy things. And there is a lack of trust, and, you know, and some of it is deserved for sure. But when it gets to the point where it becomes paranoid, it could be definitely drive you crazy. Number five, insistence that incorrect information that they got relates to their case. So I call it the case of the comparing apples to oranges. So, you know, my grandfather's sister's neighbor's brother's boyfriend's cousin's babysitter, they had radiation once and they got burned. And I'm like, well, we're not treating your breast. We're treating your prostate. You're not going to get burned. Don't worry about it. You know, no matter what, there's this insistence that their information is correct. Number six, non-compliant patients, you know, generally drive all of us crazy. There's so many patients, Jim being one of them, that just got, you know, ended up deciding not to go back for treatment because he thought he was going to die anyway. So what was the purpose? And again, that was the behavior that drove me crazy, was that he didn't come in for treatment. He was almost dead. We brought him back, and then he started the whole process all over again. So it's that non-compliance, not listening, not taking their pills. I can't tell you how many. And by the way, you guys can't hide from us. You know, for instance, I'll use thyroid cancer as an example. If you're not taking your medication, I'm going to know it. I'm going to look at your blood and I'm saying you're not taking your medication. And you could protest up and down, sideways to the moon and back. And it's like, all I need to know is how often are you not taking your medication? I know you're not taking your medication. So just tell me, whatever. Or how many head and neck patients or lung cancer patients come in and they absolutely swear with their hands on 10 Bibles that they're not smoking, but they smell like, you know, like a tobacco factory. Like I can smell it. I see their fingernails are yellow, and I see the, you know, they have, you know, cigarette stains and burnt holes in their clothing. And it's like, yeah. Okay.
And they're you know? Chewing, they're chewing gum too. They're like,
yeah, well, exactly. Number seven, another thing that drives us crazy is a belief in the non-traditional treatments. And I'm a big, you know, Angel, complementary medicine, supplementary medicine, going to alternative caregivers. I don't care if they're shamans or, you know, snake charmers or whatever they are. Nutritionists is fantastic. Even going to some of the practitioners that, you know, give herbal medicines or whatever. I have absolutely no problem with any of that, as long as you're not doing it to the exclusion of standard of care, you know, regimens, and you're not accepting the treatments that are the ones that are going to keep you alive, like Jim did. You know, he didn't want the traditional medicine and he almost died because of it. Number eight, when our patients make poor decisions based on bigotry, they may not believe in their doctors because they don't like, you know, the color of their skin or their race or their gender or their sexual orientation, or they are elitists. You know, they don't want to go to their community hospital because it's a community hospital. They feel that they want to go to the big city hospitals, but then going to the big city hospitals, you know, are a pain and they're expensive and they're hard to get to. So they end up not going at all because they have this elitist attitude toward their community hospitals, or even not taking appropriate treatments because it's inconvenient. How many people that I've seen that have foregone life-saving treatments to go on a cruise, you know, to go on the Disney cruise or to go on, you know, vacation or to go just not show up or go on a 3-week bender or whatever. Absolutely, you know, very, very, you know, off-putting and drive you crazy. Mental illness, it's sad, but it's true. But many times people who are mentally ill are a challenge for the caregivers to really be able to have that patience, to be able to take that time to spend that extra hour, spend that extra half hour, to do the extra work, to talk to the social workers and the psychiatrists and the social worker. I said the social workers, the you know, the judicial system, to make sure everyone has the proper you know, advocacy for their mental illness, can sometimes drain us. Number 10, repetition and decision paralysis. So I remember we did an episode, we did a podcast on another confessions podcast on when I took that wonderful patient who was dying of breast cancer and had her entire body full of cancer. And it was a Friday night and I needed to treat her and I had to get her treated to keep her from getting paralyzed. And we were now going on hour number two. It was about 7 o'clock at night. I had the whole staff, and no one left the building because we had to take care of her. and she just didn't get it. And then finally I hit my breaking point and I said, lady, you need these treatments or you're going to be paralyzed. Your bone scan lit up like a Christmas tree and we got to get this done. And like, I'll never forget that interaction because, she was an artist and the way her mind worked through visualization. And then she saw herself as a diseased Christmas tree, you know, full of cancer. And her husband, who was a physician, came back to see me, you know, after she passed away. And I thought he came in to see me to thank me, from keeping his wife from being paralyzed. But instead, he really gave it to me, well-deserved. Because, you know, I made the last whatever year or 2 years of his wife's life, full of that, that terrible vision of being diseased with this cancer. Number 11, shame and blame. You know, a lot of times our patients, because they're so frustrated with having cancer and they're so devastated, their bodies are absolutely betraying them. They just feel terrible. They're in pain and the disease is progressing and you give them treatment and they are not getting any better and they're getting worse and the disease is progressing. They blame us sometimes and they try to shame us in that it's our fault. And had they gone to a different doctor, things would have been different, or that you were the one that was causing all this pain. And truly it's because of the disease and not because of us. Not that we don't make mistakes. We do, of course. And sometimes we do cause pain and side effects, but I'm specifically talking about the shame and blame when it's really not deserved. And finally, number 12 is denial. It absolutely drives all of us crazy. The doctors and nurses, oncologists, and everyone, when they're in a room with someone where everything is just kind of, falling apart and you're trying to talk reason and they're absolutely in denial. No, I don't have this. I have a funny story. My beloved cousin, got rushed to the hospital a couple of weeks ago and his blood sugar was about 700. And, the doctor asked him and they said, why are you not taking your diabetes medication? And my cousin said, because I don't have diabetes. So, he was absolutely in denial about being, a diabetic, and as such, he's not taking his medication. And now these doctors have to come in and rush in and save his life. So denial is another thing that drives us crazy for sure. But what we always do on this podcast, Angel, is I talked about reactivity, physician reactivity. I used my mistake as an example. I talked about the etiology of physicians, why they react and have their temper tantrums. I also wrote down and discussed some of the things that, we need to investigate and look and make better. And then to actually openly talk about some of the things that our patients do or bring to the table that could be a challenge for us. But we've just outlined all the problems. What do we do here, Angel? Do we just discuss problems?
No.
We talk about solutions. So I know we will never be perfect. I know that I will never be perfect. And I always know, if you guys like these confession, podcasts, don't worry. They will always be here because there will always be a confessions module because we're always going to make mistakes. But we do want to make sure that we don't just highlight, just sort of go to confession and say, Father, forgive me for my sins. I did this and I was very mean to Mr. Smith. I also want to be able to help our practitioners try to come up with strategies to avoid this type of behavior. So the way we can do this is a very simple phrase. And I have a really cool example of this, and it's called grace under fire. What is grace under fire? Grace under fire is the ability for us as your caregivers, as your doctors, as your nurses, to maintain a calmness and a collectedness under intense pressure, under unspeakable fatigue, and under head-splitting responsibility, and all of the unrealistic expectations that people have of our abilities. And when I went to the internet to do my searching and do my my due diligence for this podcast, there was one recurring example of Grace Under Fire, which just kept on coming up. And I don't know if you know this, Angel, you weren't even born yet, but it was about the man who first stepped foot on the moon. His name was Neil Armstrong. Neil Armstrong absolutely personified what's called grace under fire. And what a lot of people don't know, you know, people know that on July 20th or whatever the date was in 1969, when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed that lunar module, everybody got up early in the middle of the night to watch that grainy, you know, video of them, you know, coming out of the lunar module and doing the first moonwalk and all that type of thing, the first step on the moon, and, you know, one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. Everybody remembers that. But what people really usually don't know is that when Neil Armstrong was about to land that lunar module, the computer systems, and you can imagine how primitive those computers were in 1969, overshot the landing site by 4 miles. And he was over a crater. It was a crater that was surrounded by all of these rocks and boulders. And these rocks and boulders were the size of cars. And had he landed that lunar module on one of those boulders, or had that module turned over, or even if it was landed but was not perfectly straight, it was a little crooked to one side, they would have died. They would have never been able to get back into orbit to reunite with Michael Collins, the other astronaut that was orbiting and waiting for them to do what they had to do and then come back. And the other thing that people don't realize is that he had no fuel. He was basically at the point where, had he spent another 3 seconds, you know, trying to find a better spot, they would have run out of fuel and they would not have been able to get back into orbit. And the thing that makes this such an interesting story, to me at least, is that when Armstrong realized that they were in a bad spot, he basically took the controls, and he took manual control, and he was literally, you know, flying this lunar module. Now, a lunar module is not an airplane. It is probably, I'm not a pilot, but from what I can tell, it was probably like trying to fly a tin can, literally. And you can imagine how difficult it was. Also, think about the pressure. He had his life, as well as his partner Buzz Aldrin's life, in his hand. And the thing that was remarkable, and one of the reasons why this specific example kept on coming up, was that with all this that was going on, when you listen to the recordings and you listen to his voice was calm. His voice was collected. He was absolutely, like, if you were to listen to him and not know what was going on, you would have never known how close to complete and utter chaos and potential tragedy that was going on. And to this day, I think that gets underplayed a bit. And when we talk about physicians and nurses having to confront these difficult interactions, these interactions with our survivor thrivers, the ones that drive us crazy, the ones that trigger us going to revert to that infantile behavior that I described in the beginning of the podcast. Can you imagine that if Neil Armstrong can do this and be able to have that grace under fire, you know, then it's not unreasonable for us on the Croc podcast to ask myself first and then my colleagues, why cannot we muster up that same ability to show that grace under fire? And I came up with seven different sort of endpoints before we sign off on this podcast. We talked about Neil Armstrong. Number two is being able to develop that empathy. That empathy that we talked about earlier in the episode is going to be the key component to help us be able to retain our calm and our collectedness. when we are challenged, when we feel within us, you know, that surge of anger, that frustration. Being able to take a walk in the shoes of our survivor thrivers, that has to keep us centered and keep us grounded into that grace under fire. Number three, realizing that all of our patients are different and they require a unique and individualized method of communication. Jim, especially with all of the things, I think out of the 10 things that I put as one of the things that drives us crazy, I think Jim had four of those checked off. So like he drove me crazy, you know, four times out of 10, yet realizing that his needs were different and individualized and unique should have kept me under control, kept me calm under fire. Number four, realizing that in the interaction with a caregiver and a patient, logic does not always apply. There are plenty of times when our survivor thrivers may not be logically approaching you or giving you logical information for you to be able to interpret or to be able to deal with. But you have to recognize that no matter how illogical they are, they're still logical because it's logical to them. It may not be logical to us, but it's logical to them. Number five, we need to have the insight that the survivor thrivers are our day-to-day Neil Armstrongs. They don't have to land that lunar module one time in their lifetime. They metaphorically have to land that lunar module every single day of their survivorship. So they have to take all of that pressure, all of that strain, you know, all of that terror that's going on in their survivorship as it relates to their cancer journey. And they have to be Neil Armstrong every day. So why can't we be Neil Armstrong every day? Number six, we have to be accepting of the fact that our survivor thrivers are always right. Even when they're wrong, they're always right. And we have to change our set point. We have to reframe the way we think as it relates to them. And instead of like, you know, was I right that this guy should have not called me at 5 o'clock in the morning just to talk turkey? Of course I'm right, but he's right. So one of us is wrong. Who's the one who's wrong? I'm wrong because Jim is always right, even when he's not right. And finally, Angel, we need to embrace the knowledge that grace under fire, how we interact with our survivor thrivers, no matter what the situation, is not only our duty, it's our responsibility, and it's our job. That's what we have to do. Now let's get back to Jim Smith, and we'll end this thing. Applying my own strategies, what could I have done differently? So when I got on the phone with him, I needed to say, Jim, I'm happy to hear from you and not be pissed off about it because he did the right thing. He reached out to me. He did exactly what I told him to do. I told him to reach out to me whenever he needed me. That's what he did. I shouldn't have been angry. I could have been tired, but I shouldn't have been angry. He just called me at the wrong time. Number two, I should apply loving boundaries. Now, I have every right to tell him, Jim, I'm not angry, but do you mind if we can discuss this later? Let's make an appointment later in the day when we can talk, when I, you know, can get up and take a shower and have a cup of coffee and then get to work and get myself my desk ready. And then maybe 3 o'clock, we could talk about your hot flashes and talk about your inability to sleep, your fears. You know, your oncologist told you you were dying. He really didn't say that. Let me try to explain it to you. There would have been a better way to do it. And the great news, and to end this podcast, is I called him back. I apologized to him. I told him I was wrong. I told him to forgive me. And I told him, please Never be afraid to call me anytime, 5 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, for whatever reason, I will be there for them and be there for him. And I really hope that our caregivers got something out of this today. And I hope that our survivor thrivers got something out of this today. Angel Santana, you always get the last word.
You know, I think it's pretty cool that I love this series because it humbles you as a physician. It shows people that we are, you know, that you are human naturally. But I want to go back to what you first started with, which was the joke. You know, you said that God doesn't think he's a doctor. I will then take that joke and make it what I consider reality. You know, God is the best doctor, but prayer is the best medicine. And today, I think we've seen what prayer can do. And what I mean by that is you took your time, you probably thought about it, and not every doctor would take the time to admit when they were wrong. And you know what? There's an old phrase that I use a lot, and you know it. When you're right and you're rude, then you're wrong. So I want to thank you for being honest with your Croc Nation. Thank you for being honest to your patient. More importantly, thank you for being honest to yourself, because you are what most doctors need to do, and that is be patient and understanding. So for that, I thank you.
Angel, thank you so much. Angel Santana, have faith, let it begin. Always grateful to you for your comments and for your co-hostingship. Not a word. We just make them up here. I want to end today's podcast the way we end all of them, with a quick pep talk and then with a blessing. So I will end also with a gratitude exercise and shout out. So first of all, you guys are in up to your neck, you know, in fear, up to your neck in betrayal and loss and pain and toxicity. And, you know, sometimes we're having a bad day, and we might have expectations of you guys that are not realistic, or you guys might just be pushing our buttons in one of those categories we discussed. And the last thing you need is to hear your doctor be snippy with you, to be elite with you, to be condescending to you, or try to school you in any way. You deserve love. You deserve acceptance. You deserve individualized teaching. Whatever it is, and you need as much time, as much time that you need. You are deserving of that time. Even if we have to say something 100 times, you're deserving of that. And I think that's one of the things that's really important for us on the Croc podcast, is to make sure you guys recognize how worthy you are. You guys are too accepting of a system that is broken. You're too accepting of the imperfections of the system. You're too willing to accept many of the things that are broken in the system because you're just grateful that someone's going to take care of you, and you're so fearful of this terrible disease. Well, we're here to tell you that that's not necessary. When we mess up, we mess up. Bring it to our attention. Let us know. And most importantly, know how worthy and how important you are. And that's why we're here on this podcast, to bring that message forth to you all. To Angel Santana and the board of directors, I'm really looking forward to meeting with you guys on Wednesday. I can't wait to hear your thoughts about the podcast, how we can make it better, your thoughts on how we could reach more survivor thrivers, your thoughts on how we can continue to change the world, both globally as well as with one survivor thriver at a time. Looking forward to Wednesday night. Lastly, my prayer for you all is very simple. Behalf of Angel Santana and the entire board of directors, we wish all of you, all of our wonderful, worthy survivor thrivers, a long, healthy, happy, and cancer-free life. God bless you. God be with you. And especially on this weekend, you know, is a Christian weekend, but it's really a weekend for anyone who's spiritual. We wish you peace, love, and joy. God bless you.